Congratulations.
I knew I should have worn heels. Hi, my name is Angela. I'm an alcoholic. And Sam, thank you for asking me to come and share here tonight. I didn't know where I was going, and I had no idea what a treat it was going to be to make that drive and watch the sunset. It was just beautiful. It was a little dangerous because I had to turn my head that way to see the sunset. I'm like off the road, but Alcoholics Anonymous has been such a blessing in my life that it is just, I love to be able to talk about it and share about it anytime I'm asked. And the key there is when I'm asked, because I would just ramble about it to just anybody, but I've learned from my sponsor that really we wait to be asked, and then we are able to say yes when we're asked. And that's just something I've learned and have been able to practice. My sobriety date is September 26th, 2006. I have a sponsor, and I've spoke with her on Friday. I have a home group, and I have a couple different service commitments in my home group, participate in the district, and all those things are just like the prescription I have for sobriety that I got when I first walked in the door. And I follow that prescription like a daily medication, and I don't know, it didn't make sense to me at the time when my sponsor was encouraging me to do all these things, but now I love to do those things, and whenever life gets real weird, I can go and look, kind of review the prescription, so to speak, and I can figure out where I'm missing something. Part of my triangle's not being filled in, like maybe I'm not fellowshipping, maybe I'm not hanging out and having coffee and talking to the ladies. It can be that simple, but I'll get disconnected real quick if I'm not participating in all areas of the triangle. So when I was little, I was born in Richmond, Virginia, and my parents had me when my mom was 18, my dad was 19. They were very young. They just graduated from high school, and they had a shotgun wedding, and they were really they were kids. They were kids with a kid. And moved out to California. My dad was in the Marines. And my mom loved California because it was so crazy liberal. And, you know, she had grown up in this little 50s, real nuclear conservative family. And she just kind of got to go wild for a little while and loved it out there. And I see pictures. I don't remember any of that, but I see pictures. And I have these vague memories of arguments about beer. Just these, where my mom would say, there's not enough money to buy Coca-Cola. Why are you buying beer? And that's just a memory I had when I was real little, because I thought it was really special to have a Coca-Cola. And why is it that we can't have one, but Dad can go out and buy beer, and that we don't really need to have that either, you know? So I remember that. So there was this conversation, this discord in my family about alcohol, even from when I was really little. And when I was probably about five, we moved back to Virginia, and immediately my parents split up. I think because they had like their security of their families again, and now they can go ahead and split up. I mean, they weren't like isolated in California anymore. And so that became more issues about alcohol in my home. Now, I'm just a kid witnessing arguments about alcohol. And I didn't know that I was going to be an alcoholic. I always thought, well, gosh, that must be a really bad thing. I'm not going to do that because look at all this problems that's caused in my home. And I remember one Christmas Eve, the holidays are on us right now, and I kind of reminisce about holidays from the past during the season. And there was this one Christmas Eve where my parents had a party. It was one of the times that they had gotten back together, split up back together, and they had a Christmas Eve party, and my dad was really drunk, and he and his like best friend got in like a drag out fight in the hallway in my home. And I remember crying about that and thinking, it was terrifying to me. And all I kind of took away from that was I would never eat cheese crackers, these cheese straws again and sausage balls again, because for some reason those two food items were at this party. All this bad stuff happened, and now I hate those things. Sausage balls and cheese straws. Yuck. You know, never, it didn't have anything to do with the alcohol, right? So even at an early age, like, I really couldn't identify what the problem was. As I got older, my parents both, you know, we continued to have issues about alcohol in the family, and I swore I would never drink, and they got divorced, and my mom started moving me around to different places, and I went to high school thinking, okay, you know, I've got this formula on how to do well in high school. I'm going to be really involved in lots of extracurricular activities, be a cheerleader, you know, date the quarterback. You know, I've got this formula on how I'm going to do high school. Because to me, there's like this game that you play, and you've got to, I've got this like check off list of, okay, if I get this, I'm going to be okay. If I get this, I'm going to be okay. If I wear this yellow jacket, I'm going to be okay. I mean, I literally always had to find a way to be okay. So I get to high school, and my mom, in the middle of, right after my sophomore year, actually it was right at this time of year, it was New Year's Eve, my sophomore year, she says, I need to tell you something, and she says, we're going to move to the other side of town, and you're going to change schools, and, you know, we're making this fresh start with her new husband. Well, you know, I had my checklist. It was all complete. I felt like I was doing well, and now she wants to kind of pull me out of my okayness and take me to this other school. Well, I hadn't had any alcohol. Up to that point, I hadn't really been interested in alcohol. I mean, I just had this formula that I was using to be okay. And when she told me she was going to do this, I kind of got really scared. And I started thinking about, you know, I'm going to have to start all over. When, you know, my whole checklist is blank again. And she drove me out to the place we were going to live, and it was on a lake, and we had a bottle of champagne in the car. And she was letting me sip off of it, and she didn't realize it, but by the time we got over to the place we were going to live, I pretty much drank the whole bottle of champagne. And so I went from, and I walk out on this dock on the lake, and there's all these glittering lights, you know, all around the lake. It's, you know, it's New Year's Eve, so those Christmas lights are still all out. It's a really pretty neighborhood, and I walk on the dock, I sit down, and I still have more champagne in my hand. I think, I look around like, oh, everything's going to be just fine here. You know, everything's fine. I'm going to be okay. And I didn't realize it, but it was the alcohol that had made everything fine for me. So, you know, my life can be in this complete upheaval, but then I realize that once I get that drink, I'm okay. And so that next day I was very ill, and then about a week or two later, my friend said, someone's having a party, and I said, we've got to get something to drink for that party, you know, and I did it again. And so I went from drinking like Dom Perignon to the party at Mad Dog 2020. You know, it's like, and those are my first two drunks. And both of them really ended the same way. I was sick. I was hungover. My head killed me. I couldn't get out of bed till afternoon. And both times I'm like, I can't wait to do that again. We moved and everything, and I have my checklist for school, but this time I've got this extra thing on my checklist, and that is get something to drink for the parties. And literally on Monday, I would start planning my Friday or my Saturday. And it was really hard to get alcohol because the laws had gotten stricter in Virginia, and drugs were much easier to get, but I wasn't really interested in drugs. And so I literally started planning the weekend. As soon as we got into school Monday, I'd start talking to people and start planning on how we were going to get alcohol for the weekend. And that kind of behavior, it's so funny because, you know, I went to college and could drink anytime I wanted, but then when I got married and had children, I started doing that again. I couldn't drink all during the week, but on Monday I would start planning who was going to watch my children on Friday, what I was going to drink, where we were going to go, you know, and even though I could control the drinking down to one day a week, my whole rest of the week was, I was obsessing over the one day I was going to drink. And of course that managed and controlled drinking, didn't last for long, but that was just one way I did control it. I've tried to control my drinking by over-scheduling myself. I've tried to control my drinking by getting married, having children, working two jobs. I've tried to control my drinking by eating dinner early. I've tried to control my drinking by taking medication instead of drinking. I went through a phase where I couldn't go to sleep without alcohol, so I started taking Benadryl, you know. And then I knew, because I knew that if I took Benadryl, that if I drank either one or two drinks, that was all I would be just out. I mean, that was all it would take. And so even though if you had asked me when I walked in this room if I had ever used drugs, I would have said no, but that was using drugs. And I used them to control my drinking because, like, if I had something big the next day, I would know, okay, I don't want to have a hangover tomorrow, so I can control my drinking by taking with this, you know, medication that makes you drowsy, so now I won't overdrink. I also would say, you know, I never drank in the morning. Well, that's not true. I drank, like, after midnight all the time. I was very, I mean, I drank until it was all gone, you know. It was in 2005 that I feel like I became unable to manage it at all. In 2005, we decided to move from one house to another. The economy was, it was really a good time to sell a house. So we started fixing up our house, and my husband was scraping wallpaper, and he brought home, like, some beer, and I thought, well, it's Monday. We don't drink on Monday, or I don't drink on Monday. And he said, well, you know, we're scraping wallpaper, and it's so boring, you know. And I thought, that's true. It's so boring to scrape wallpaper. So we'll drink while we scrape wallpaper. And it was like once that door was open for me to drink, like any night became okay to drink, I was at a place in the progression of my disease that it was just, It completely got out of control so fast. So in 2005, when I started drinking on like Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday, I went through a really severe a progression. And by 2006, well, my daughter who started kindergarten in 2005, and I was going into her kindergarten class in the mornings, and I'd be so hungover, I would be dry heaving in the bathroom of the kindergarten classroom. The teacher knew something was wrong with me, and she'd say, Mrs. Bruce, I hope you're okay. And she'd say, okay, now you take care of yourself. And she knew something was wrong with me, but, you know, I couldn't tell her that anything was wrong with me. I was participating a lot in my church. I was teaching 2-year-old music. And I remember I'd go to the class. Sometimes the music class didn't start till 6 at night, and I would be so hungover, it would just take all I could do just to go there at 6 o'clock at night to teach. We had Monday morning Bible study, and I would eat peanut butter stuffed in celery on the way to Bible study to cover up any smell that was left on my breath from Sunday. Peanut butter is really good at covering up the smell of old beer. And so those are just some things that I was doing. Well, it really, okay, that summer, one of the other things I did was I would look in the mirror and I would say, oh, look at all these broken blood vessels on my face. You know, so, and I remember someone telling me that one of the side effects from too much alcohol is you get broken blood vessels in your cheeks. And I looked in the mirror and I just saw all these red squiggly lines, and I got this green stuff and I would put it on my cheeks to kind of blend out that red. And one day I just looked, I was like, I can't believe I'm putting green stuff on my face before I can even leave my house. I mean, it just had gotten so incredibly complicated how all these measures I was having to take to cover the alcohol, control the alcohol, find times to drink, get people to watch the kids. It just was so complicated. And I got to the point where I look at myself in the mirror and just not even know who I was. Why am I existing? I would have fantasies about, like, leaving and going to Greece, or fantasies about getting a 2-seat car that would only fit, like, me and my dog, and just, like, taking off down the road. And But yet, my innermost desire was to be a really good mother. I really loved being a mother. I mean, ever since I was little, I wanted to be a mother. I mean, if you had said, what do you want to do when you grow up? Number one would be, I want to be a mom. And, you know, and husband or no husband, that was never, like, the number one thing. It was always just to be a mother. And so I had actually had what I dreamed of, you know, two really smart, nice, fun, healthy children. And but I couldn't enjoy it. I had had this book called 3-Minute Bedtime Story so that I could read these really quick bedtime stories so I could get in the bed and I could go drink, you know. When they were awake in the mornings, they would be up early, I'd say, children, I don't know who has kids, but in the morning, kids are just at their most fun. They're always perky and fun and creative and easy to get along with in the mornings. But I wasn't. I was the opposite of all those things in the morning. And I would just say, okay, it would be Saturday. I'd say, if you would just, if you let me sleep till 8, I will make you pancakes. But if you let me sleep till 9, I'll put chocolate chips in them. And so, and you know, I was just trying to buy any time for my kids. I would just put movies in all the time for them so that they would just be entertained with a movie. I would take them to little playgrounds where I would have like a big thermos cup of whatever drink I wanted to drink that day, and I would watch them play while I drink out of that drink. And so I just wasn't involved with them at all. And so even though I had this, what I thought was my dream, I wasn't really living it to even what I knew was my potential to live it to work to. So in 2006, when I finally, that summer, I said, you know, maybe I'm just, this alcohol thing, I need to stop fighting it. You know, because I was spending all this energy on trying to control my drinking and hide it and all that. And I said, you know, I'm just going to stop fighting it. Maybe I just drink every day and that's just who I am. And oh my gosh, when I like kind of surrendered to the alcohol, which is what I was doing, wow. I got just sick fast. And it was just that one little summer. But I was literally, you know, drinking almost every day, drinking during the daylight hours, you know, drinking before dinner. And, you know, it was summer, so it's okay. But literally, I had surrendered to alcohol. I had stopped trying to control it. And somehow I was invited to go to some sort of a church where they talk about 12 steps. And I went to this church, and they were talking about 12 steps, and I heard some interesting things about a God different from the God that I had been learning about, or that I thought I was learning about in my Bible studies and all that. And I started hearing ideas about addiction and about alcoholism, and I started hearing this open kind of dialogue and people sharing like really personal things that I would never share. This was in like a church setting. It wasn't even an AA setting. And then I heard the lady say, now this program does not replace AA. I heard her say that. This is the leader of this church. She said, so if you're in this or if you have this kind of addiction, this does not replace it. You need your own group to go to. And so that really struck home with me, and I thought, okay. So I started going with a friend to some AA meetings and just visiting with her to be supportive. And it was amazing. When I heard people talking, I thought that she had told them I was coming and to talk about these certain things that were like, sounded like, you know, I'm like, God, did she tell them my personal stuff, you know, before I got here so that they would talk about what was going on with me? It really, really felt that way. It really felt like it was my story that I was hearing other people share. And I think I went maybe about 3 or 4 times, and you know, it was like, well, I identify, but I didn't want to identify. I didn't want to be an AA, because I think I really knew that AA meant that you couldn't drink at all. If you're really alcoholic, I mean, I knew enough to know that if you're really alcoholic, you really can't drink anymore. And so I kept holding out thinking, maybe I'm not really alcoholic, you know. So then my church decided to have some sort of a 12-step-ish kind of program. And, you know, they're real general. When the churches do it, they're real general. They're not AA. They're like any, you know, hurt. They say hurt, habit, or hang up. And but they apply 12 steps from the AA 12 steps to, like, religious principles, and they incorporate it all together. So my church was going to have some sort of a 12-step program. So I said, okay, that's it. I don't have to join AA. I'm just going to go to the thing that my church has. And it was a Tuesday night, and I went to my church, and I walked up and down the halls looking for this thing they were supposed to have had, and I couldn't find it anywhere. And I went to the security guard, and I said, do you know of this class that they're supposed to have here tonight? And he said, what class is it? And I didn't even know what to call the class. I said, it's something about recovery, and he said, I don't know, and then I went back home and went online. Oh, no, oh, so I was going back home, and on the way home, I just thought, you know, if I go home, I'm going to drink. And if I go home, I don't want to drink tonight. I mean, I was going to this thing at church because I don't want to drink. And, but I know if I go home, I'm going to drink. And I remember just driving down the road and just crying because I knew that I was at that point where I didn't want to drink, but I didn't have a choice anymore, and I had no more control, and that was where I think I really knew at that point that I was alcoholic, without anyone telling me I was alcoholic, being at that point where I no longer have, and I don't think I ever had a choice before, but I thought I did, you know, I guess I just kind of came out of my delusion. Just for a window of time, just enough time for me to go to an AA meeting and then to just be pulled up out of my seat by a force, not myself, to pick up a white chip. It wasn't me. I didn't want to pick up a white chip. I didn't really want to quit drinking. I mean, you know, I really didn't feel like it, that I was making that decision. I really didn't. But I picked up the white chip, and it was a Thursday. And I was so relieved, and I was so full of hope, and I was so, I just felt like this huge burden had just been pulled off my shoulders for just that short amount of time, and that was through the day, but then, you know, 11 o'clock at night, that night, I didn't feel so good. I'm thinking, okay, the liquor store is still open, I mean, the, you know, whatever, 7-Eleven is still open, my husband's still drinking, but I can't drink, you know, because I've got this white chip. And I just was holding on to that white chip for that week. And finally, I got to a week of just, you know, what do they call it, white knuckling it for that week. And I went through that week, and that Thursday, I was like, whew, I made it through a week, and I just got drunk. And, yeah, and that drunk, it was just like the ones before, except that, you know, I got to the point where the alcohol didn't really help me feel better anymore. Literally, I could drink and drink and drink. I mean, I could hardly stand physically. I could hardly stand up. Physically, I would look like I was really drunk and all that, but mentally, I was all there still. The mind kept going, and that was something I experienced earlier in the summer, and it was a scary place to be, because I remember this one day I'd spent all day long putting in this herb garden and drinking at the same time, and then my neighbor comes over, and I say, oh, you've got to come see my herb garden, and my mind is like, blah, 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 and I want to tell her all about all the different things that I've planted and what likes what and why I did this, but yet I get up to just walk over to show it to her, and I'm falling down. You know, my body was completely drunk, but up here was clear as the bell. And that is not where I want to be, you know. As an alcoholic, I need the alcohol to make the mind be quiet. So, and I know you know what I mean. So that Thursday night, I was so happy I made it through a week, and that Friday morning I was ill, sick, hungover, too hungover to even make it to a Friday morning meeting, which there was one that I liked at 10. And finally that Friday night I went to what's now my home group, Jaywalkers, and I went in there, and I was scared to go to nighttime meetings because I might see someone I know. And sure enough, there was someone I knew from church there, and I was like, oh my gosh, my, you know, it's like, okay, well, that was the, what I was most afraid of, so God went ahead and just threw it out there right up front. You know, really, I was most afraid that I would go to an AA meeting and see someone from church. You know, never mind why they are there. I mean, it's all about me. It's all about, I don't want anyone to see me in the AA meeting. So God just put that out there. There was a lady from church at the AA meeting, and I mean, it was just like, wow. And it was great because I realized that it wasn't a big deal. And people had said, you need to get a sponsor, because I talked to someone after me, and I said, you know, I just didn't drink for a week, and I got drunk last night. And then they said, you need to get a sponsor. So the next day I met with a lady and asked her to sponsor me. And then she said, you know, you need to go and pray about it. She gave me all these criteria of what she asks of her sponsee. She said, I ask you to do what I do, and here's what I do. And I thought, and she went through this list of all the things that she does. You know, she calls a couple people every day. She shows up early, 15 minutes early to all her meetings. She has three committed meetings every week. She meets with her sponsor once a week. And I'm thinking, you know, she's just saying that she does all this. She doesn't really do all this, you know. But I was at the point where I was like, yeah, I'll do it. And I was not willing to do it. But I would just say, I would say whatever it took for her just to sponsor me, because I knew I couldn't do anything by myself. This program, she was like my tour guide of the program. You know, I knew that she would show me what to do and where to go. And I would just worry about each individual request as we came to it. You know, I kind of thought that I could pull one over on her, that I could just say that I would call two people a day. I could say that I was 15 minutes early. She wouldn't really know, except that she was going to all the same meetings I was going to. And I would get there, and she'd already be there at the meeting. And and she said, oh, and you have to get a home group and a job in the home group. And my job was greeting, and I'm supposed to be there 30 minutes early. She would get there even before that. And see that I had not gotten there at the right time. And so I really couldn't pull anything over on her. And she was, you know, I really enjoyed the way that she sponsored me. It was, she shared with me all these details about herself first before I shared anything with her. And she told me all about her drinking experiences, and I just started to relate to her I learned how to kind of start to talk about things that before I never could talk about. You know, through my life, I never really had a best friend that I told everything to, because I was always too prideful to tell everything to anybody. I didn't understand how to be a friend. I didn't understand what true friendship really was. I didn't understand that you could tell your innermost secrets to your best friend and they would love you anyway. I thought that was impossible to be loved like that. I didn't know that was real. People, I know that they wrote that on birthday cards and sappy cards. And I would never buy a sappy card because I thought they were all a bunch of junk. I thought they were lies. I didn't realize that was a real place you could be, that you could really cherish friendships like that, and that you could really feel that way towards other people. So I don't even buy sappy cards. I write the sappiest stuff now in my cards. And I mean it. That's what's so funny, is that I really mean it. You know, before I would have said, oh, that's just BS. No one really feels that way. But that's not true. So my sponsor was pretty rigid, in fact, with the way that she sponsored. But that's how this whole sponsorship line is. And I thought, golly, all these rules, but I didn't want to lose her as a sponsor. So I told my husband, I've got to follow these rules, because if I don't, I got to find another sponsor. And I mean, I'm too prideful to have to ask someone else to sponsor me. So I stay with her at night, and I learned a lot about going to workshops and doing like road trips with other ladies we did like a retreat weekend, and I started just having fun in AA. And she did a lot of service, and so I would go and do service things with her, and she got me involved in the treatment committee, and so all that was great, but I wasn't doing my steps. And you can stay sober for a while just doing fellowship and doing a bunch of service. And so for the first year, I was really happy when I'd come into AA and I'd go to my service commitments and I'd, you know, do my home group stuff. And I was all happy. But by the time I'd get home to my driveway, I am mad. I'm like, I know I'm going to get in that house and the dishes aren't going to be put away and the clothes are going to be mildewed in the washer and no one's going to have eaten and I'm going to have to do it all. Oh, you know, and so I would get to AA, be all happy and having a good time. And then by the time I got home, I had like changed personalities. I was not the same person. I was angry. No one could do it right. You know, my husband did it wrong. My kids were misbehaving. And it was because I wasn't doing recovery. I was just doing service and fellowship and not doing any of my step work. You know, I got to the third step and thought that there was supposed to be magic. And it just, I was like, what's happened? Nothing's happened. And they kept going, well, you need to keep going, you know. So, of course, that was my sponsor's fault, and I had to change sponsors, right? And I know, of course, that it was me not being willing to do the steps. That's the truth. And she knows that, too. We laugh about that now. But I changed sponsors thinking that that would help me. And because I think that's what we do. You know, when we get to a place where we become unwilling, it's not, I can't see it as it's my fault. I think it's someone else's fault. And not even that I thought it was her fault. I think that, you know, I thought it was just like her sponsorship style isn't for me. You know, that's the kind of stuff I would tell myself. And so then I got this other sponsor that I thought would be different because she was from Las Vegas. She was a really, really strict sponsor, but I did what she said, and I started writing my fourth step, and I wrote it, I completed it. I had started it with my other sponsor, but I hadn't really, really finished it, and it was amazing how different I was on that paper than who I thought I was in my mind. The evidence was there on the paper of who I really was. All my character defects, all of the inner resentments and all these inner, like, selfish motives that I had and then all the fear that I had. I had no idea that that was in me. And I didn't know what to do with it. I mean, it was really just, it was garbage. It was like I was full of trash and garbage I don't know. So I didn't know what to do with all that stuff. And so she said, well, now we just need to keep going through the steps. And we're going to start praying over each one of your defects of character, which she helpfully pointed out what they were. Well, we talked during the fifth step. She helped me identify my defects of character. And so I kept praying for them to be removed. And, you know, they just weren't being removed fast enough to my liking. And She started coaching me on how. She was like, okay, well, here's your defect, so just act opposite. You know, maybe it's not really going to be removed all the way, but just act like it's been removed and just act opposite of that. And when it would be like a person that I had some sort of resentment about, I would start to pray for that person, you know, in my daily prayers. And it was just amazing how just through some actions and some prayers, you know, I don't think that my defects are completely removed, but my defects were actually transformed. So when I told, you know, when I did the prayer about, you know, God, heck, take all of me, I realized that God loved all of me, good and bad. And it was at that point that I could understand that God's going to take my bad just along with my good, and that it can be used. And not in a harmful way, but in a way that will help someone else. But, you know, a lot of that didn't happen until after I was making amends. Because I think in that amends process, it gave me the courage but after doing the amends, it gave me the experiences to see the results of what happens when you just, you're really scared to do something and you just keep doing it anyway and you just walk through that fear. And then to have the experience of looking back and to see, oh, that changed me. Oh, that changed my relationship. Because for so long I believed in God. I had faith that God worked for you. I believe that there is a God, and I believe He created me. But I had to have some experience with God to then have the trust on the other side. So currently I, So currently I've been working with a newcomer, because that's something that we do. It's a 12-step work, is the sharing with others. And it's been amazing to see how much of her experience matches mine. And I've been able to identify new ways through her sharing with me for example, she said, well, she remembers that she used to go to the grocery store to buy wine. She put a bottle of wine in the cart and then put a bunch of food on top of it. And I'm like, oh, I did that too, you know? And I had forgotten that I even did that. And then I also have been talking to more of my friends that aren't in AA about my experience in AA, and that's new for me because, see, I was living up until about a year ago, I was still living this kind of like a double life where I have this church person, you know, and my friends at church, and then I've got my AA life over here, and I was very much keeping this double life going in recovery. And that's not comfortable. That's it's really false, because people will say, where are you every Friday night? Why weren't you home Friday night? And I'm thinking, oh, I was out with some friends. And then they'd say, you're gone every Friday night. What are you, in a club? Or, I mean, you know, and so I realized that I was actually perpetuating dishonesty with just a few friends, you know, friends that really care where I am on Friday night. Not many people really care where I am. But so I finally started opening up to more friends, not just the ones that I made amends to, because the ones I made amends to, I did tell the truth all the way to. But some other ladies, and it was amazing because one lady that I shared with, I said, you know, I just want to tell you about what's going on with me. And her brother's in recovery. Her brother's in AA. I've met him. I mean, it's, you know, and to think that I was so shallow is to think that I can't tell people the truth about me because whatever. I just more and more am realizing that I don't know what's best for me, and I don't know who should know the truth about me, or it's just my job to be truthful. And it's my job to be honest with the people that are close to me. And so that just opened up a new perception. And, you know, this whole process has been about me changing my perception. Going through the steps, it's just a lot about my life is the same. But the way I think about my life is completely different. You know, I still have the same job, the same husband, the same kids, the same car, same house, you know. A lot about my life looks the same. So I don't have this, like, dramatic story to say, like, you know, I came from here and now I've got this. You know, really, it's just the way I look at my life is different. My relationships are transformed. That's where the biggest transformation has occurred for me. Because when I learned how to make an amends, I learned how to mend. I learned how to maintain relationships. I learned that you can mess up with friends and you can make it better. You don't have to disappear out of their lives forever. Because I thought that if you did something bad to someone, that you could never be friends with them again. I thought that if you messed up or if I messed up, that was it. I just blew all my chances. It's over. You know, might as well quit that job. He'll never, you know, my boss will never respect me again because I did this mistake. You know, and by learning to make amends, I've learned how to use that process in all the areas of my life, and practice these principles in all the areas of my life. And I like the way that we say practice, because it is practice. And I get it wrong a lot. And I'm allowed to. I get to make mistakes. And I get to fix those mistakes later. And sometimes I don't even know it's a mistake until I talk to my sponsor, and she points out that it's a mistake. I don't have the same sponsor from Las Vegas anymore. She moved back to Las Vegas. And when she moved back to Las Vegas, she had said she might be coming back. So I said, oh, well, then I'm going to keep her. I'm not going to change sponsors because I didn't want to change. You know, I had so much personal growth with her as my sponsor, I was scared to change. But when she went to Las Vegas and she got a new sponsor in Las Vegas, she let her Richmond sponsor go and got a new one in Las Vegas, I thought, she must not be coming back, because why should she have done that, you know? So when she got a new sponsor in Las Vegas, you know, I said, okay, I got to do what my sponsor does. My sponsor got a new sponsor, I need to get a new sponsor, you know? And that was a little bit painful for me because, you know, I'd kind of grown up with her. But I do love the sponsor that I have now. And you know, she's a little bit different. She's a little more open-handed with the way the requirements, the sponsorship. I don't even know what to call them. But she's a little more open-handed with that. And it's fine for me. I still stick to the old way because it works for me so well. And I just read something about that, and it was just talking about when we're learning, when we're going through these spiritual growth, it's kind of like this learning curve. You kind of need to be in a structured type of environment for a while to kind of get your roots planted in. Like when you think of like a little seedling, you don't just take a little seedling and stick it out in the middle of the woods. You know, you put it in a little pot and give it some boundaries and, you know, nurture it, and as it gets bigger, you can give it more space, and, you know, and I kind of feel like that, and, you know, now I'm kind of in Madison in the woods, and, you know, and now I get and our roots get to, like, go deeper and deeper, you know, and enter, and then connect with each other, and then we help support each other that way, because now I'm not in the little pot anymore. I'm kind of like, I guess I'm in a little transplant pot. I'm about that big now. So, but, you know, this whole program is just, for me, it's just all been growth and constantly being willing to try something different that I don't want to do. I just had to write, actually, I didn't write it yet. I've been asked to write a new little miniature kind of inventory about my relationship with my husband, and it's changing, and it's, you know, last year I was in a place where we were about to split up, and now we're in this new place where he's, like, going to meetings, and I don't even know what to think of it, and my sponsor's like, don't think of it, you know, just don't think about it, just keep doing what you're doing, and God will work on your relationship, and that's the truth. We went to the party last night at the intergroup, the big New Year's Eve party, and we had it wasn't perfectly comfortable. Because I usually go to the New Year's Eve party and hang out with all the ladies, and we go dance and, you know, be silly on the dance floor, and now I'm there with my husband, which is really, because he never would participate in anything in AA with me before because he liked to drink. So it was just a new experience, but afterwards, I was really glad that we went. You know, at first, I'm thinking, this is going to be weird. This is going to be uncomfortable. I think I'd rather, why don't we just rent a movie and stay home, you know? And then I have to remember, okay, that's my default alcoholism mind telling me to isolate, stay home, don't try anything new or different, status quo. And then by about 8 o'clock, I'm like, that's it. I'm getting in the shower. We're going. You know, I had to go. You know what got me there, to be honest? I had committed to bringing desserts. You know, and that's, again, service. I committed to bringing desserts, and I had them all baked and ready to go, and I'm thinking I could just go drop them off real quick and come right back, get a movie on the way home, you know. But I knew that I need to not do what my default position is, especially when I'm in a sensitive, vulnerable place like my marriage. I need to do what AA has told me to do all along and show up and keep my commitment and reach out to the newcomer and remember all that, because I still get in that weird, raw, vulnerable place. I mean, I was in it yesterday. And thank goodness that what I'm taught here resonates. What I'm taught here and what I hear all the time, because, see, I go to 3 meetings a week or more. And so I hear that same message all the time, like, don't do what you want to do. Do, like, the opposite of what you want to do, you know, when you know you're in that kind of weird place. And you know, that's important for me to keep going to meetings, because if I didn't, I wouldn't hear that, and I wouldn't take the same actions that I chose to take last night. So it was kind of uncomfortable, and it was kind of weird, but, you know, oh, I'm so happy that we went. There were some people that were new that were there, and people that are just sober. This is their first New Year's Eve that they're sober. I would not want that again. But, yeah. But when my first New Year's Eve sober, I went to that AA party, and there was some ladies there that hung out with me and showed me that, hey, we can go get on the dance floor even though we're not drinking. We're going to have fun and be silly and goofy and crazy, and you're going to have fun, and I did. And so I wanted to show up there last night to do the same for the next person. And there was even members of my home group that were brand new sober people, you know, this year. And they were in my home group, and to be honest, there wasn't anyone else from my home group there, but I was there. And I was really glad that I was there for them, you know, because they're my homies. And so I just stuck close to those new people. And you know what? My husband's one of those people, too. And you know what he said on the way home? I said, oh, that was really fun. I'm really glad we went. Thank you. I thanked him. I said, thank you for going with me tonight. That really meant a lot to me. You know, there's that, you know, that mushy stuff I don't like. Yeah, I used to think people didn't really say. And I said, that really meant a lot to me that you went with me tonight. And he said, you know, he said, next year will be better. I'll know more people. And I thought, oh, I can't wait to tell my sponsor that he said that. Because she keeps asking, you know, what's going on at home? What's going on at home? I'm like, nothing. Okay, come over. You know, I go over, and then I'm like, oh, here's what, you know, then I tell all the truth. It's hard to tell the whole truth on the phone. One-on-one works much better for me. I think that when I see my sponsor face-to-face, and, you know, we can, like, hold hands and pray, and we can talk. We just have this whole different level of honesty face to face that we don't have over the phone. And so that's why it's important for me to have a sponsor in Richmond and not have the Las Vegas sponsor that I tried to hold on to. So, One other thing that I'm doing is right now is in my meditation. In my morning meditation and evening meditation, which is, I don't know how to distinguish the difference, but I've been doing different readings, but then I've been writing my prayers out in this little, like, I just bought a calendar. It's like a regular daily calendar, but I write prayers in the day of that week or whatever. Sometimes it's in the morning and sometimes it's at night. And it's really been a nice experience for me, because I was having a hard time with finding my own meditation. You know, I copy everyone else's, and then someone will say, well, here's how I do it, so I'll try that, and here's how I do it, so I'll try that. But I don't know. This has been working for me in a way that's really nice, because now I can go back and read my prayers from last week, and then I get to see how that came about, or how that came true for me, or how that prayer was answered, and a lot of times it's just how I was given strength for some certain situation, and I'm praying for other people in writing, and that's helping too, because for me to see it in writing, it might be someone I'm angry at or someone I'm not particularly fond of, and when I pray for them in writing, and by a week later I look back at it and my perception of that person has changed. And I haven't even really thought about it, but for some reason, just having prayed and written it down, it does it. God does it. you know. It's out of my hands. Once it's, like, out there and, you know, I've given it to God, and it really does help me, and it's helped my relationships. I guess I really don't have anything else to say, but thank you for being here. And I know when I leave, I'm going to think of all these things I wanted to tell you, you know, because I've got a lot of good stuff. But thanks for having me, and I look forward to seeing some of you guys in Richmond.